Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Max Verstappen wins again, leading another straightforward 1-2 victory for Red Bull Racing ahead of Sergio Perez in Jeddah. You're listening to the F1 Strategy Report. My name's Michael Laminato, and this is Round 2, the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. Another round, another Max Verstappen win, though the Dutchman had to work marginally harder in Jeddah than he did in Bahrain. The pole getter momentarily lost the lead during an early safety car that shuffled the order, though the aberration lasted only 3 laps, with Verstappen blasting past the out-of-position Lando Norris to resume a lead on lap 13 that he'd never relinquish. That safety car largely defined the finishing order, with only 4 drivers choosing not to pit but finding little joy with the alternative strategies. The exception, though, was Nico Hülkenberg, who snatched the final point of the race to rocket Haas to 6th in the title standings with a perfectly judged strategy by the American-owned team. Let's take a closer look at the key moments of the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix now with Ed Straw from The Race and, of course, The Race F1 Podcast. Ed, it's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, and particularly for choosing me for such a race of strategic variety and excitement.
Look, a lot of people think they're cursed whenever I ask them on the show, and I think that's more of a reflection on the sport than an individual person, but perhaps that's a broader discussion for another day. I want to start with these Saturday races. We've had 2 of them now, not for any particular tactical purpose from Formula One's point of view, other than the logistics of getting in and out before Ramadan. But I've got to say, I've come around to the Saturday race. I like that the Sundays wrap up and by Monday you're a normal human being again.
Yeah, it's strange. I think probably you're in a better place to judge those who are listening on the outside, because it was just normal. It's just I just always thought it was a different day to what it actually was.
Yes.
So I just thought Saturday was Sunday. And every time we've done little bits to camera for Instagram and that kind of thing, we keep getting the days wrong because you're so used to Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's really hard to judge. I certainly don't mind it. And it's nice to have an extra day before having to head off down to your neck of the woods in Australia, given that's always a bit of a trek. So, yeah, I don't mind it. I'd be interested to know whether a few people were caught out by it in the watching world, whether that impacted the figures. But, yeah, Saturday's interesting. I don't mind a little bit of variety. We've got 24 race weekends, so we might as well have a few on a Saturday.
Shake a couple of them up at least, I think. That's a good call. Let's look at this race in particular now. 4th running of this Grand Prix in a little over 3 years, really. And it's part of this generation of circuits that I like to think of as being more than others. It was designed with somehow being more in mind, in this case the fastest street track in the world, more speed, I suppose we could sum it up here, supposedly with 27 corners, only so many braking zones, I guess, but a lot of them are blind. It was very extreme when it was debuted on the calendar. I think in the 4th year, while obviously a lot of those characteristics remain, it feels like it's been tamed a little bit now. Is that just a matter of getting used to it? Has Saudi Arabia found a bit of a niche as a circuit?
Yeah, I think probably people have got used to the challenge, as you say. There's still that concern that one day someone will come through one of those blind sweepers, encounter a slower car and get launched into an almighty accident. But by and large, the drivers are pretty careful to try and avoid that. It's usually practice just in inattentive moments where you have that. So they got used to it. They have done a little bit of work to open up some of the corner entries, the sight lines and that kind of thing, and make the curbs a little bit more forgiving. So they've chipped away at it. The drivers generally do consider it one of the more dangerous circuits. There's no question about that. But I think they also quite like the challenge. But it's an interesting track, isn't it? Because although it's a high-speed track and there's all these fast sweepers, there's actually quite a lot more to it, because you've got the lower speed stuff as well. Turn 1-2, they drop down to 3rd gear. You've got those long sort of hairpins at turn 13 and at the effective last corner as well that are slow, and a range of high-speed corners. So it's got a nice varied challenge for the cars and the drivers as well. So, yeah, I think everyone enjoys it, even though there's that slight fear of something going wrong one day.
Well, hopefully we don't get too seriously down that road, but certainly the speeds and some of the onboard footage really gives you a sense of the danger and the risk around this circuit. Not too much risk for Max Verstappen this weekend, it's got to be said. Never really challenged throughout the weekend. Was briefly headed by Lando Norris. One of only four cars that didn't stop behind the safety car. And we'll talk a little bit about how this safety car really, the whole race really hinged on this moment. It was between lap 7 and 10. Took Max Verstappen only another three laps or so to make his way past Lando Norris and resume regular programming. It's not for the first time a well-timed or a badly timed safety car, depending on your point of view, has effectively neutralized most of the strategy in this Grand Prix, Saudi Arabia in particular. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons for this. I want to talk about the track itself in a literal sense, the tarmac. It's so smooth, degradation is so low here. Is there any alternative universe in which we got anything materially different anyway from this race?
Yeah, I'm not sure there was. You could argue, actually, that the safety car potentially made it more interesting because there are a few situations that it created with Lando Norris and Lewis Hamilton were the two significant cars that stayed out, plus what went on with Magnussen and helping out his teammate by being a rolling roadblock. So those two situations were created by the safety car pit stops. And had it just gone on as normal, everyone would still have been pretty much on the same strategy. As you say, super smooth track surface. It's pretty high grip, not very abrasive. Massive contrast to Bahrain. So really gentle on the tyres. And that's the overriding factor. And yeah, although the safety car made it super predictable because 14 cars pitted at the same time once Lance Stroll had crashed, you weren't going to see huge amounts of strategic variety had that not happened. So yeah, I don't know whether we'd have been better off with or without it, because fundamentally this is just a very flat race strategically. That's just the way it is. They definitely could have done the whole race on the hards, on the C2s. Pretty sure they could have done most of them, the full race distance on the C3s, the mediums as well. So it's just not a tyre deck one. So it's a race where you can push and attack, and there's not much scope for strategic variety.
This isn't the only super smooth track on the calendar with the characteristics you described. It tends to be the case on newer street circuits in particular, especially these sorts of hybrid street tracks. You know, I'm thinking back to places like Sochi, admittedly no longer on the calendar. Is this a byproduct just of that kind of track, these sort of semi-permanent, semi-designed street circuits? And considering we have an increasing number of them on the calendar, that is sort of Formula One's modus operandi at the moment, is this something the sport should be taking into greater consideration, considering we do inevitably get quite samey strategies, quite predictable races on these kinds of surfaces?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, they're just very, very good track surfaces. And obviously, although this is a street circuit, it is a permanent venue, really. You could call it almost a pseudo street track, if you like. And yeah, they have these really high quality surfaces. And they're all quite new as well for these tracks. One of the reasons why the contrast with Bahrain is so extreme is Bahrain has been basically there for 20 years, that track surface. It's pretty rough. So when you get a certain degree of the homogenization of the more modern tracks with the track surfaces, this does happen. And you can get high levels of grip without that abrasiveness. They always talk about the difference between the micro roughness and the macro roughness, because people might assume that high grip always will mean there's high deg, but you do get this weird combination where you get very good grip here at somewhere like Jeddah, but not the abrasiveness. So it's something that's worth thinking about, although fundamentally I think F1 should be very careful about relying on the tyres and tyre deck to create the variety and the excitement, even though it is the thing that can create the most variables of pace within a race. And of course, variables is what creates racing, because if one car's quicker than another car at one point in a race, and then it's flipped round because of strategy and that kind of thing, that's how you create overtaking with faster cars coming past slower cars. So you could just basically argue that the track surface is too good in Jeddah, but deliberately making things a bit worse and more patchwork, that's a little bit more tricky, isn't it? So, yeah, I don't know whether it's wise to go down the route of trying to tune the track surfaces, but there are clear reasons why this kind of track creates this type of race.
We just hope as the calendar grows, not too great a percentage of tracks end up feeling similar. You'd like to think with 24 races anyway, we won't fall into that bucket of risk, but we'll wait and see. This is the second race now of the season. As you've said, fairly different situation to Bahrain, if not just because so many of the front runners, and that, by that I mean the group of cars behind Max Verstappen, but in the points essentially, was a smoother race for most of them. In Bahrain, we saw a great many problems. Many drivers had reliability issues, pretty much except for Carlos Sainz, although it was his turn this weekend with appendicitis, which is fairly significant compared to brake problems or something like that from Bahrain.
Does that count as a reliability issue?
it's a physical reliability issue, I suppose, in a way. Needed maintenance. Was back at the track on Saturday as well. It is only one kind of circuit. It is a kind of wacky circuit for a variety of reasons. But do you get the sense now with two fairly different races in the books that we've got a reasonable handle on the competitive order behind Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, Aston and Mercedes? Or is it just at the moment still being defined by these teams' kind of weaknesses when they approach these circuits rather than a sort of really definitive competitiveness?
Yeah, it's not completely definitive. We still need some more sample sets of data, some very different circuits coming up. But it does allow us to, if you like, triangulate the performance a bit more because we've now got a couple of data points. And it confirmed a lot of what Bahrain hinted at. We know Red Bull's a class apart. Ferrari is best of the rest. And then McLaren, Mercedes and Aston Martin are there. A lot of the weaknesses and strengths of those cars were confirmed. So the McLaren's great in high speed. There's points on this track in Jeddah where it's quicker than the Red Bull. There were also points where it was a lot slower because it's weaker in the slower corners, not so great on top speed. We saw in Bahrain, the Aston Martin, for example, pretty quick over a single lap, not so quick on race pace, which is flipping the script for that team because historically they've always been very good at having the race pace and not necessarily maximising the qualifying pace. So we've seen that from Aston. And then we've got Mercedes, who are a little bit all over the place. They had their cooling problems in Bahrain. And then here, Lewis Hamilton, probably everyone heard complaining about the loose rear end, not having the confidence, alarming echoes of the year before. And I think we did see that Mercedes has not got quite on top of some of its problems as it hoped to with this car. As we mentioned, this is a smooth, fast circuit. So that means cars running very low, stiff. They were hitting some bouncing problems. They were also having points when the car was close to the ground, when it wasn't producing the downforce anticipated. And to stress just how weak the Mercedes was in the high speed, that run from turn 6 to 10, which is just fast sweepers, the Mercedes was the slowest. It was slower than the Alpine by like 7 miles an hour, something like that. And the Alpine's terrible. So pretty serious problems for Mercedes there. It's not going to show up at every track, but it shows there's still that point when the aero gets really complicated, when the floor is close to the track surface, which is already exponentially more complicated to simulate and understand, and when you're relying on the suspension to be stiff enough to support everything but still compliant enough to work on the curbs, it's a bad combination for Mercedes. So that's probably the biggest learning. Mercedes has still got problems. And we also saw that there's sort of the split in the pack. You've got the top five teams and then the bottom five teams. And the joke that's increasingly being used in the paddock is that those bottom five teams, so that's RB, Sauber, Alpine, just about, Williams, Haas, are competing to steal a point off Lance Stroll. is the way it tends to get joked about. So, it's Nico Hülkenberg who got that. So I think it actually confirmed quite a bit from Bahrain, but gave us a little bit more about where everyone's shaking up. And I must admit, it pretty much puts everyone in the areas of strengths and weaknesses that we'd expect. But I would say it's good for Ferrari because it just shows their car is more stable and consistent and gives the drivers confidence. So Ferrari will be pretty content with that, even though there is this horrible pace gap to Red Bull.
Get ready, race fans, because the ultimate NASCAR experience is about to hit the airwaves. Welcome to Pit Pass NASCAR, the podcast that takes you deep into the heart-pounding world of NASCAR racing.
Join us each week as we bring you closer to the NASCAR action with exclusive interviews and all the news and rumors you need with your favorite drivers, team members, and industry insiders.
So whether you're a fan of super speedways, short ovals, or road racing, or you've just watched Talladega Nights, Pit Pass NASCAR is the podcast you've been waiting for.
Get ready to fuel your passion for NASCAR like never before. Subscribe now to Pit Pass NASCAR on your favorite podcast platform or head to evergreenpodcast.com and get ready to join us.
Launching in the fall on Evergreen Podcast Network. Follow us on social media at pitpass_NASCAR to stay up to date with everything you need to know about the podcast.
I want to move now to that bottom part of the field and one of the interesting strategic moments of this race, or tactical moments of this race. You mentioned it there. Haas scored what is a really rare and valuable point for a midfield team or a backmarker team. I don't know what we're going to end up naming these groups of cars. We'll go for midfield for now. It sounds a bit nicer. Nico Hülkenberg finished 10th after some well-judged defensive teamwork by Kevin Magnussen. albeit after Magnussen really cooked his own race with two 10-second time penalties after that safety car. I really like the effort required to score this single point. In a weird way, it feels like the same amount of effort we might conventionally think about being required for a race victory, such as this gap. I want to talk about that gap in just a second, but that was Magnussen backing up everyone outside the top 10, pretty much essentially to build a gap for Nico Hülkenberg to drop into, Hülkenberg having not made a pit stop during that safety car. I want to start with this Haas car, because it doesn't actually seem like that long ago it would have seemed unlikely that the team could have pulled off, or the car, more to the point, could have pulled off a strategy like this. Is this all just that really attentive pre-season work under new team boss Ayo Komatsu to figure out the problems with these cars? Is this a really positive sign for Haas?
I think it is positive. Ultimately, quite a bit of the work was already being done. I don't think you can say everything's down to the change of leadership, because the tire chewing problem they had last year was fundamentally an aero problem because they had aero instability. So that's been something that's been worked on for a while. And obviously this track wouldn't show up that weakness anyway, because not only is it gentle on tires, it's also a front limited track. And the Haases weren't so bad on front limited tracks last year. It was really the rear tires that they were eating. So there's a little bit of that on the technical side. Plus, pre-season, as you say, Ayo Komatsu's strategy was absolutely focus on race pace, really, really understand that. And that has paid them back with a car that does have good race pace and also retains a pretty handy turn of single lap speed as a happy coincidence, you could say. And actually, the Haases were a little bit quicker than qualifying show because they both had problems. And although the team's been very good operationally, that qualifying day, I was going to say Saturday, the Friday, of course, was a bit of a disaster for them, because in Q2, they didn't get fuel into Hülkenberg's car, which is why he stopped. It wasn't that they forgot, they just had some form of equipment problem. They thought they put fuel in and it did not have fuel enough, so he stopped. And Kevin Magnussen, they just had some timing error because he went out, did an out lap, did a prep lap, so it was two laps before his final Q2 lap. And then about halfway around that prep lap, he's just told, oh, push, you're tight on time. And he was 3, 4, 5 seconds away from doing it. So they messed up quite a few things on the Friday. But then they had a car that was quick enough to do something in the race. And it was very sharply executed. Obviously, Magnussen had driven into Albon, that got him the first 10-second penalty. The really interesting thing was that second 10-second penalty he got was for passing Tsunoda going off track, which was a slam dunk penalty. He absolutely gained an advantage. But that put him ahead of Tsunoda to be the rolling roadblock. And the team, I was going to say AlphaTauri, Visa Cash-Up, RB nonsense, they were not very pleased with it. Alan Permain, who's their sporting director now, having been at Benetton /Alpine/Renault, whatever, for donkey's years, he said it was unsportsmanlike, he felt, because Magnussen shouldn't have been ahead. And then when Tsunoda later got that past Magnussen was very robust in sending it to bully his way back past. But it was a great effort by Magnussen, because whether or not he should have been there, he was. He was given a lap time to aim for of 1:36, something like that, which he did pretty much consistently while keeping people behind him, which is not an easy thing to do. I think there's only a few drivers who could do that. Magnussen's good because he's belligerent in battle and quite good at executing those sorts of races sometimes when you're running to an unusual plan. I remember there was a Hungarian Grand Prix a few years ago when the Haas was terrible. He wasn't being a roadblock, but he was just having to execute a race, having gained track position very well. Sometimes he does that. And yeah, probably someone like Fernando Alonso or Esteban Ocon, probably the other one who could do these sort of lunatic defensive drives. So really, really clever from Magnussen. And I think, although you can, others will be a bit frustrated by it. Tsunoda said it was a bit unfair, but he understood why they did it. Just hats off to them for executing it. And it bought a lot of time. It didn't buy Hülkenberg a few seconds. He had to buy the vast majority of a pit stop cap for Hülkenberg. Did it perfectly, rewarded with a point. And so that point was Magnussen's just as much as it was Hülkenberg's, because Hülkenberg himself also did a good job, but he had the simpler task.
Let's not get into half points, though. I never liked half points. They don't look nice on the table. Execution turned around for Haas. A really good point. It's execution that really could be making the difference for any of the midfield teams, because that one point, I know it's only round two, it sounds sort of weird to say, but has put Haas up to 6th in the constructor standings ahead of all the other teams with no points, which really points to this large gap between the two halves of the field. As you sort of said, this really needed Lance Stroll to crash out of the race to be made possible. The strategy wouldn't have worked in other circumstances. The front runners this year, as we've sort of already talked about, they seem fairly close, depends on the track, but more or less. The backmarker seem really very close, but that gap is so large. Is it too large for the average race to be entertaining in a series, I guess, that's increasingly looking down the field for points of interest?
It's a funny situation, isn't it? Because the field's actually pretty condensed across the board. It's just Red Bull that's ruining the curve for everyone just by being so good. Or you could argue it's the other nine teams who are ruining it by not being as good as Red Bull. So, it's a funny situation. In a way, I quite like the fact there is quite a nice split in the field because it means you do have quite a nice Class B. And it means whoever is the best outside the top five teams will normally have done a very, very good job overall because it's so crowded in that part of the track. So, yeah, it's a weird situation. But as to that point, in this race, if it wasn't for Magnussen being in that unusual situation of his race being ruined by the penalties he had, certainly one penalty before he got the one for passing Tsunoda because that was integral to being able to do what he did. But if that wasn't there, that would have been less interesting as well. So, yeah, there's an element of circumstantialness behind that, if indeed that's a word. So, yeah, it's very difficult because one of the problems when you've got quite a close pack, they're all running at similar speeds and they all sort of drive around in DRS trains and cancel each other out. So it's not necessarily a great ingredient for good racing. But I quite like that little split in the field because if you're the best of the second group, you can get ahead of the odd car who's struggling. Yuki Tsunoda got into Q3. He was quicker than Hamilton and Behrman. So it's close enough to be interesting. But fundamentally, I think for the season, you just need Red Bull to be less good, or rather the chasing pack to be better, because they are just so good, and hats off to them.
Yes, delicate line between needing a team to be less good and everyone else needing to be better. To wrap this one up, you mentioned him there. Oliver Behrman was one of these stories, maybe the story of this weekend. There's no easy way to make an F1 debut at Saudi Arabia, but doing it on a Saturday before final practice, getting the call up only a few hours before final practice, must be the hardest way. Did a great job handling the pressure in practice and then qualifying 11th, finishing 7th for points on debut, holding off Lando Norris and Lewis Hamilton on that alternative strategy of not stopping behind the safety car, stopping for softs late, couldn't get pace out of them. Two-part question to wrap this up. First of all, how impressed were you with Behrman's weekend? And second, what meaning can we draw from this not really usually being the Ferrari way? It's normally about having established drivers in the car and really doing things by the book, if you like. In this situation, they went for a fundamentally untested rookie, a guy from F2 with only a couple of years of car racing under his belt. Is it the palate cleanser we need after Nick de Vries to try and get some circulation back into the grid?
Well, maybe there's a little bit of that, although we should say when de Vries dropped in for Albon a few years ago, Albon also had appendicitis. He did a really good job. What happened after doesn't devalue what he did at Monza. But yeah, on the question of why, what it says about Behrman, it says that Ferrari have got confidence in him. He's one of a number of reserves they've got knocking about the place. They could have had Antonio Giovinazzi, Robert Schwartzman as well. They're all there in the mix as reserves, but they've been doing WEC and they were not in Saudi Arabia. Behrman was, and obviously it fits in well with his F2 schedule. But it's very positive that not only are they confident enough to do that, but when Sainz first started feeling ill, they didn't panic and think, oh, quick, we better get Giovinazzi over just in case. They thought, well, if it's Behrman, it's Behrman. That's fine. Obviously, they initially only expected that Behrman might have to do, say, FP1 and 2, because he was on standby on the first day, because they didn't know Sainz had appendicitis. So it says they're confident in Behrman. They threw him in. They didn't run around and think, oh, who's a handy, experienced, safe pair of hands? So that tells you Ferrari know he's capable. He's only 18, Behrman. So you're putting a lot of faith in him, because it's not just a weekend you could lose in terms of not getting any points, but a young driver getting ahead of themselves could very easily stick a car into a wall, cost you a chassis, have a big impact downstream in terms of damage to parts, your cost cap spending, etc., etc. So a great show of confidence, and I think they quite liked the chance to have a good look at him because they see him as someone with a future. And in terms of the quality of performance, I was very impressed. It's really difficult to do this. Yes, he was tuned into the track from F2. Of course, he took pole in F2 and then was withdrawn from F2 to concentrate on F1. He didn't do the first day of running. So dropped straight in into a car he hadn't driven before and did a very good job. He was setting decent times immediately. I quite like the fact that he was, although he was very happy with the way stuff went, he was a little bit disappointed after qualifying because he knew he should have been in Q3. His execution wasn't quite there. And then in the race, there was still that bit in the back of his mind where he sort of missed it. Oh, well, if I'd been a bit more in position, maybe I could have finished a couple of places higher up. And certainly fifth place would have been possible had he, say, started around 7th or 8th or something like that. He pulled off some nice overtaking manoeuvres. Great pass on Tsunoda. A little bit of a dummy pass. He was quite happy with that one. So I just think it was really good. It showed he's got the mindset to do this. And most importantly, I think it showed that he didn't just go in to do a safe job. He knew this could be a career-making opportunity. Because if you get the chance to get into an F1 car, you've got to nail it as far as you can. Otherwise, you may never get another chance. And then you layer on top of that, he's driving a Ferrari of all things. It's not like a low-profile drive around down the order. Huge amounts of pressure. And I was just very impressed with what he did. So it shows not only is he a quick driver who can execute, but he's got the mindset and the mentality. And I think that near as makes no difference guarantees he'll be on the grid next year. It has to. Haas are already very interested in him. And there's even sort of a vague chance if Magnussen struggled this year like he did last year that it could be changed mid-season. So I think we'll see Ben in a full-time drive next year. And Ferrari will be thinking, maybe there's someone here who could be a long-term driver, which is a good position to be in for Behrmann, because although they've got a new signing coming in next year, Lewis Hamilton is not a young man. So they might think, yeah, this shows he's made of the right sort of stuff. So, yeah, great success for Behrmann. And he did a good job for Ferrari, bringing home some points. At the end of the season, if it's a close fight in the Constructors' Championship, that could be significant, those 6 points that he brought home on a weekend when they could easily have had none out of the science car.
And the great thing is, in a Saudi Arabian Grand Prix that had very little competitive tension at the front, it will still be a race that will almost certainly be remembered for the fact that Oliver Behrmann made his debut and will probably end up becoming a long-term Formula One fixture down the road, maybe as soon as this year, or if not next year. So an interesting Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. For that reason, we forget most of the other things, if necessary, and move on to the next race. Ed, thank you so much for joining me for the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Just give me a more exciting strategic race next time.
Another Red Bull Racing comfortable one to finish in Saudi Arabia. A very different track to Bahrain proves the RB20 is working across a growing spectrum of circuits. Ferrari is optimistic that a few targeted developments will put it within reach of applying some pressure, but we'll have to see it to believe it. Thanks very much to Ed Straw from The Race for joining me to debrief the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. Subscribe to The Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts, and if you enjoy the show, we'd love it if you could leave us a rating and a review. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. Special thanks to Ben Loke from Bloke Designs for the show artwork, and our theme music is by Simon Hosford. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you in a couple of weeks for the Australian Grand Prix.
Stay ahead of the pack with the latest racing news and interviews from the Hammerdown Racing Report, your source for regional racing action as well as the national scene. Every week, we recap racing action from all around Northwest Ohio and Southeast Michigan and cover national racing series from the world of outlaws to NASCAR. Plus, get all the latest racing news. Join hosts Scott Hammer and Ron Miller, along with different featured guests each week. From dirt to asphalt, we have you covered. The Hammerdown Racing Report, available weekly on your favorite podcasting platform.